The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. This week on Century of Lies, we'll hear more about the impact of marijuana legalization in the states that have moved to regulate and legalize adult social use. And we'll have a tribute to the memory of Dennis Perrone, the yippie and social justice activist who sadly passed away at the end of January. But first, the current president delivered the annual State of the Union address recently. In essence, an elderly white man read a speech that someone else prepared. He did so without straying too far off of the script, without using any racist or sexist slurs, and without using any language that would have to be bleeped per FCC regulations. For that, the current president even applauded himself. Among other things, his scriptwriters included some lines committing the current incumbent to a renewed drug war. The day after the official State of the Union address, which got horrible ratings, all things considered, the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights held a news teleconference to discuss the state of civil rights in the U.S. Let's hear now from that teleconference. Here's Vanita Gupta, Executive Director of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights.
I'm Vanita Gupta, President and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, a coalition of more than 200 national organizations working to build an America as good as its ideals. I want to thank everyone for joining this call, and then especially my friends, Grace Martinez, who's the Advocacy and Policy Director of United We Dream, Desmond Mead, President of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, and Farhana Kara, Executive Director of Muslim Advocates. Donald Trump's 75-minute performance last night only confirmed what we already knew about him. He's dangerous. He's a danger to our nation's most vulnerable, a danger to our nation's values, and a danger to our nation's democracy. In fact, the past year has exposed Donald Trump's extreme agenda to undermine our democracy by attacking our fair and accurate census, our independent courts, and our constitutionally guaranteed right to vote. You're going to hear from Grace and Desmond and Farhana about really important organizing work that is being done to vindicate the rights of everyone in this country and then to ensure that the most vulnerable marginalized among us are able to participate in this thing that we call a democracy, so vitally important. And I want to touch on a couple of these democracy issues first, and then we'll pass it on to my fellow speakers. On the census, first, Donald Trump and his policies are a danger to a fair and accurate census. And why should we care about the census? The census actually determines political representation and apportionment in the House of Representatives. It's an issue that isn't enough talked about, and yet it stands at great risk due to a lack of funding, a lack of leadership, and insertion of a political agenda by Jeff Sessions' Justice Department in seeking to add a citizenship status question to it at this very late hour. The insufficient and late funding has already delayed and derailed really important census testing and preparation. There's a very big concern about the lack of leadership at the Census Bureau, a rumor pending right now that they would be appointing somebody by the name of Thomas Brunell, who has no management experience whatsoever and has been very engaged in Republican gerrymandering of congressional maps in several states. And I think the most alarming piece right now is that in December, the Sessions Justice Department asked the Census Bureau to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census. That would greatly harm the ability of the most vulnerable and hard-to-count communities to participate. And so we're urging everyone on this call to raise this issue with your member of Congress and to raise your voice on this critical issue. It's vitally important that we get this right. It's a constitutionally mandated function, and we have one chance in every 10 years to get it right. We live with the consequences of it for the next 10 years. On the courts, Donald Trump has been a danger to our courts, which has been an important venue to vindicate civil and human rights for all communities. Trump's nominees are the least diverse set of judicial nominees in decades, and more than 93% of his nominees are white, and nearly 76% are men. Trump has only nominated one African-American and only two women of color. In fact, Trump has replaced 10 of Obama's nominees of color with white nominees. His strategy, though, is to remake the judiciary in this fashion in his own image, pale, male, with extreme views that are truly off the charts. in the Eastern District of North Carolina is a perfect example of his strategy. President Obama nominated two distinguished African-American women to fill a seat that has now been vacant for more than 12 years. It's the oldest judicial vacancy in America. And each nominee would have been the first African-American and second woman to serve on that court. But North Carolina's Republican senators prevented them from getting a hearing or committee vote to hold the seat vacant. And now President Trump has nominated Thomas Farr to fill this vacancy, a man who worked with Jesse Helms to suppress the black vote in North Carolina and withheld information about his role from the Senate Judiciary Committee. The civil rights community is determined to stop as many of Trump's unfit nominees as we can. Last month, collectively, we were able to stop three of them, Brett Talley, Jeff McKeer, and Matthew Peterson. These nominations failed because our communities stood up and spoke out, and we need you to contact your senators. We need people who are in Washington to be present in the Senate committee hearing rooms and to raise your voices on social media, wherever you are, to oppose the stacking of our courts with extreme nominees. And before I move on, voting rights. We know Donald Trump and his administration have been a danger to our right to vote. From day one, the Trump administration has embraced a dangerous voter suppression agenda that threatens full enforcement of our voting laws. For instance, in the Husted Supreme Court case, the Justice Department reversed a longstanding interpretation of federal law by arguing that Ohio should be able to purge voters from its rolls if they haven't voted in recent elections. And this is contrary to what the Justice Department had been saying for many, many years. The right to vote is enshrined in the Constitution. It isn't use or lose like cell phone minutes. And to justify losing the popular vote, Trump alleged that 3 to 5 million people voted illegally in the 2016 election. He then created the bogus Pence Kobach Commission, stocked with vote suppressors like Chris Kobach, to lead his voter purge strategy. But the civil rights community, our communities, fought back and defeated the Pence Kobach Commission. And this is a really big victory for everyone in this call and for millions across our country. But we know that this administration is not done with the assault on voting rights, and the fight is not over. And we need your help in your states to fight for automatic voter registration, early voting, for same-day registration laws. And we have to work together to push for the restoration of voting rights for returned citizens, and ultimately for restoration of the Voting Rights Act. We're asking for everyone's engagement now.
That was Vinita Gupta speaking on the state of civil rights in the United States during a teleconference held January 31st. You are listening to Century of Lies, a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. Loyal listeners will recall that in a recent show, we heard from several state officials and from the Drug Policy Alliance about the state of marijuana policy in the states that are legally regulating the adult social use of marijuana. After the speakers gave their presentations, the call was opened up for questions.
What has been the impact of legalization on the number of arrests for marijuana-related charges in these legal states? And really importantly, to ask the follow-on now, to what extent do racial disparities persist post-legalization?
This is State Representative Jonathan Singer. I'll chime in first here on this one. I think that's a really salient question, and I can work to get you the hard numbers on this, but what I can say is that overall, marijuana-related arrests are down. That being said, minority-related arrests, specifically as it relates to minors in possession, so adults or children under the age of 21, has actually gone up for minorities specifically. So African Americans and Hispanic Latino community members who are charged with this minor in possession is actually going up. And it was a relatively small number of folks in the first place that were getting charged with this. So the percentage looks a lot bigger than the actual number is. But it's something that we have to dig a little deeper on and look a little closer at. And it's something that we're continuing to work on and, frankly, struggle with to ensure that we aren't disproportionately affecting communities of color. That being said, one of the things that we did last year is we actually created a fast-track process for individuals who had committed marijuana-related crimes prior to the passage of Amendment 64 to legalize recreational marijuana. And so we do now have a bipartisan solution for folks who have committed those crimes prior to 2012 and would now be considered engaging in legal behavior, to have that opportunity to have a faster, cheaper way to seal their records so they can move forward, whether or not they want to participate in the industry or just want to, frankly, get on with their lives.
We're only 22 days into this, but we plan to track it. And there's some specific cities that we're going to look at over the next year to see what it's like. And one of the reasons I got into this, my colleague from the Bay Area said to me that 40% of the people in San Francisco, and I'm saying San Francisco, who received some type of cannabis violation, were African American. If you know anything about San Francisco, we only represent 6% of the population. So how can 6% of the population have most of the crimes in that area? And so we planned, from a state perspective, we plan to monitor cities like San Francisco and other places where there have been disproportionate arrests of people of color for cannabis.
Thank you, Representative Singer and Assembly Member Joan Sawyer. This is Jolene Foreman with the Drug Policy Alliance. I'll just add a little bit to the comments that they already made from the report findings. With the dramatic declines in arrests, way fewer Black and Latinx people being arrested for marijuana law violations, but unfortunately, racial disparities persist in the remaining violations. For the most part, in most states, we actually see youth violations going down, even though marijuana is only legalized for people 21 and over, but Colorado is kind of an outlier with that. And so we make some recommendations to really address the persistent racial disparities in the remaining marijuana arrests. And those recommendations in the report include decriminalizing marijuana for youth and young adults under 21 years of age. California did that in Prop 64. They completely decriminalized marijuana for youth, and now it's only subject to community service or drug education or treatment. It's not punishable by fines or fees that may result in kids inadvertently getting caught up in the youth justice system. In addition, most offenses have been decriminalized for young adults. And those penalty changes are all retroactive. In Colorado, to address the very concern that Representative Singer raised, they, in addition to the kind of record clearing provisions that he mentioned, there's also a youth diversion program. So youth that are stopped for, you know, really minor marijuana offenses like possession can now qualify for diversion rather than entering the juvenile justice system. In addition, there's some other kind of forward-looking solutions for addressing these remaining disparities. We see that many people are getting cited for public consumption of cannabis. We particularly see this in Washington, D.C., and the vast majority of people who are cited are Black, so there's huge racial disparities there. So one solution to that is permitting businesses to allow on-site cannabis consumption. So people who are homeless or live in public housing or have no safe place to consume marijuana can go to one of these stores and consume a legal product lawfully without fear of arrest or citation. And finally, you know, marijuana legalization reduces the number of ways that law enforcement can stop people for marijuana law violations, but it doesn't reform police practices. So to truly end these racial disparities, we need to change police practices and to do away with racial profiling.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Peyton Gwynn with the Star Ledger.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my question. This is actually a decent follow-up on the question before me. maybe best if this one goes to Jolene, but I see in the report here that Washington spent over $200 million on marijuana enforcement between 2000 and 2010. One of the concerns that people have in New Jersey is that while there may be a reduction in spending on enforcement like what they saw in Washington, they would also be spending more to enforce, you know, these new marijuana laws, things along those lines. Did you come across any of that in your report?
That's not well documented yet. You know, legalization is still fairly new. Colorado was the first place to implement their laws, and their regulatory program has only been online for 4 years. What we have seen from the limited data available is that, you know, after all of the tax revenues and cost savings, the states are still saving money after the new kind of enforcement that they're doing. It's still a net positive for them, but Representative Singer may be able to add to that.
Yeah, this is Representative Singer here. So what I would say is what we have done to sort of put a belt and suspenders on this is we have looked at, you know, specifically gray market enforcement and black market enforcement to ensure that we aren't additionally contributing to that unintentionally. And so we have set aside out of the literally now hundreds of millions of dollars that we've accrued through marijuana taxation, approximately $7 million for this black market, gray market enforcement. And so I'll be looking forward to a report, hopefully in the next few months, about how those dollars are being spent and have been spent and what reductions in the gray and black market that we've seen. One of the interesting things about Colorado's medical marijuana legalization regime is that we did allow unregulated grows for a long period of time, and there are still exceptions that allow for largely not seed-to-sale tract grows, but actually just registration with the state for certain circumstances. And so we're trying to really winnow out who are the bad actors in this world and who are the people that are genuinely growing for sick patients. So we have set aside those dollars, and you know, once again, out of over $100 million last year and $200 million this year, we have set aside a small percentage for those types of enforcement, and I'll be looking to make sure that those dollars are spent wisely as we move forward. But we haven't seen, every time we hear about these ancillary costs related to additional law enforcement concerns, we set aside the dollars, we try to do the right thing, and I'm just looking to see whether or not there are actual results related to this, or whether or not this is just sort of the last vestiges of, you know, what we can call reefer madness.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Mickey Norris with The Leaf Online.
Hi there. Sorry, I was on mute as well. First, I want to applaud Assemblyman Joan Sawyer for introducing the Assembly Bill 1578 that will limit the activities of the feds and protect the legal market here in California. But one thing he said I'm a little bit concerned about, which was that it sounded like he was inviting, while he wants to protect the legal market, sounded like he wanted to invite the Fed in to crack down on the illegal market. And we all know that they can be very heavy-handed and install these horrific mandatory minimum sentences. So I'd like to know, how can we, aside from that, we have the 20% of the revenues that will be going to state law enforcement to ensure that Prop 64 is implemented in the right way, and also to go after illegal. So why do we need the feds to come in and crack down on them, and how can we limit the carnage that could be done by the federal intrusion into California?
So by working with, and not necessarily having them, like the federal government, controlling all aspects of the crackdown on illegal, cannabis. We cannot be soft on illegal operations. We just can't. And I'm not talking about adding additional sentences. I'm talking about closing down a business. I'm not talking about going into people's homes and arresting them for smoking cannabis or going in some senior center because they're using cannabis to help the seniors. I'm talking about the illegal operations that kind of thumb their noses at what, I'll be honest, that what the people of California voted for, what I worked very hard and my colleagues worked on to come up with regulations that make sense and provide the opportunity for business to grow and all this. It is not in our best interest to have that underground economy continue. If it does, if we don't do anything, if we're soft on them, they will undermine what everybody on this phone call is trying to do. And we have to be, we have to show that this is the way to go. And if you don't want to go that way, we have to shut those businesses down. I'm all for using the money from cannabis to help encourage those that need some help in getting into this business, changing their business, the way they do business, learn how to fill out their income taxes, because I know this, at some point this will all be legal, and 5 years from now we'll all be laughing about this conversation when we are able to bank, when we are able to fill out our IRS tax return. This business side is serious. It is no longer your mom and pop selling drugs out of the back of the store anymore or in somebody's apartment. This is a business, and just like if you don't pay your business taxes, if you're operating a restaurant and you don't have all the proper food and drug notices that you're serving food that won't poison you, it's the same thing here. You don't want cannabis out there that has chemicals in it. Quite frankly, I don't mean to be crude, but feces, other things. This is a real thing, and we need to put all our efforts into making sure that the individuals who want to do the right thing get support from us. And so hopefully you're not thinking that we're trying to create something whereby we go after the legal ones. We're going after the illegal ones to hopefully force them into becoming legal.
Yeah, this is Roseanne. I'm just going to jump in here because we have 2 minutes left and we have two more questions, so I'd like to try and fit those in.
Okay. Our next question comes from Michael Krawitz with O'Shaughnessy.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. An article on the VA, new VA policy and VA secretaries. Comments about research. I was just wondering if anybody had a comment about working with veterans to participate in the new industry or encouraging veterans to participate in the state medical marijuana programs under legalization.
This is Representative Singer. I'll be real quick because we don't have that much time. But what I will say is that is something that has been, once again, a bipartisan effort here in Colorado. You saw when we added PTSD to the list of qualifying conditions for medical marijuana last year, which is a bill that I carried, you had vets working hand in hand with other medical marijuana patients to ensure that everyone got access to a medication that could potentially help them with their, you know, serious mental illness. On the same level, we actually have there's a cannabis owner. The name of the company is Americana. He's a retired Marine veteran, and his name is Dan Anglin, and he has one of the largest recreational marijuana businesses in the state and actually provides preferences to retired military and vets. So it's something that we're keeping a close eye on and something that has really, you know, just emerged organically out of our regulative regime.
I'd like to just add one quick thing, which is that not every state permits vets access to medical cannabis, which has been shown to be beneficial for treating PTSD, and all states that have legalized marijuana for adult use now give vets a way to access that necessary medicine.
That was from a recent news teleconference announcing the release of the Drug Policy Alliance's new report, From Prohibition to Progress, a status report on marijuana legalization. That report is available as a free download from the DPA website at drugpolicy.org. And finally, legendary organizer and activist Dennis Perrone has passed away on Saturday, January 27th. I first met Dennis in 1983. I just started a chapter of Normal at the University of Iowa, and with a few friends, I was going to my very first Normal conference. I was 2 weeks away from turning 21. Because one of my friends and mentors back at Iowa, Jack Club, two B's, the Boston spelling, was a Yippie, I got to meet a lot of the other Yippies there at the Normal conference, people like Aaron Kay, Dana Beal, the late Ben Mazel, and of course, Dennis Perrone. Dennis was there with his friend, Jonathan West. We hung out a bit that weekend, went to a march in downtown D.C. To end U.S. intervention in Central America. Went along with Hans-Georg Baer, the German Green Party drugs minister. It was an amazing time for my first Normal conference. It inspired me to continue. Dennis was really inspirational. Met him again in 1985 while I was working in Portland, Oregon on the Oregon Marijuana Initiative campaign. He came up in 85 to help us to get on the ballot. In fact, while he was there, we had had problems trying to petition in front of grocery stores in the middle of the city. So we'd occasionally have a petitioner take an arrest at a grocery store in order to try and force the issue in court. I took a bust one time, and when I got out of the Multnomah County Justice Center, Dennis and John Sajo came to pick me up, and we went and got some Chinese food and relaxed back at the office. It was a great time. Dennis started Proposition P in San Francisco after his partner Jonathan West died of AIDS. He saw that marijuana helped. Marijuana gives you the munchies, and it's not just the basis of bad commercials. It also is a lifesaver when you are starving to death because of AIDS or cancer. Well, Jonathan inspired Proposition P, and then Jonathan's memory also inspired Proposition 215, which was Dennis's brainchild. Prop 215 legalized medical marijuana in the state of California and started the process, really kicked off the legalization of medical marijuana across the United States. We have a lot to thank Dennis for. Rest in peace, old friend. And that's all the time we have this week. I want to thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network, on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. The executive producer of the Drug Truth Network is Dean Becker. Drug Truth Network programs are available by podcast. The URLs to subscribe are on the network homepage at drugtruth.net. The Drug Truth Network is on Facebook. Please give its page a like. Drug War Facts is on Facebook, too. Give its page a like and share it with friends. Remember, knowledge is power. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh, and of course also at Drug Policy Facts. We'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of news and information about the drug war and this century of lies. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.